G'day, mate.
How are you?
I'm good. I've been up since 3 a.m.
3 a.m.?
No, wait. I went to bed at 3 a.m. That's a bad introduction.
That's a good introduction.
No.
It's honest.
It is. Have kids, they say. They won't keep you up all night. I left night shifts, and now I'm doing night shifts.
So, you don't do night shifts anymore?
I try to avoid them. If I never have to do a complete night shift again, I've succeeded. But every time I say that, I end up doing a night shift somewhere in the next 4 weeks.
So. What was your last night shift?
It was actually on a film set.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was paramedicing on a film set.
Yeah, cool.
We went all the way through till 5 o'clock.
Ugh.
Yeah, it was a bit, how you going? The difference in doing a ambulance night shift and a movie night shift is they feed you 5 times during that shift from a gourmet food truck.
What?
Yes. And I'm still complaining.
Does it make it better?
The drive home still hurts.
Try to stay awake. Window down, head out, some loud music on.
That's the only way to survive. Lou, I apologise. Welcome. How are you?
I'm good. I have
This is Lou.
Not been awake since 3 a.m., so I'm doing much better than you.
Looking far more fresh and energetic than I am, so... Lou's probably going to direct the conversation and I will just lip off from the side.
How good. Hey, Lou, you are the third host of the Shift Extension.
Hello.
Excited?
I am.
That's a rapid promotion.
I know.
Yeah.
Long way to follow.
Did we even interview you?
No.
Maybe we should.
Do you want to do it now?
Okay. Welcome.
Welcome. Thank you.
What are you even asking in an interview?
Can you please tell us about a time that you've been responsible for the clinical care of a patient without supervision?
What's your favourite way to cook an omelette? What's your favourite omelette filling?
Ooh.
Can you please tell us about a time during work that you've had to manage conflict and resolve it professionally?
Ooh. Yes.
Do you add butter to your eggs?
Yes.
We would also like 4 referees. You can choose.
No worries. Personal or...
Or
can they?
she's just directing. They're going to be personal referees. Look, I think she's hired. Lou, welcome to the podcast. It's going to be wonderful to have you as a recurring host as we unpack some of the more, I don't know, what would you call them, Nick? Points of paramedicine that just, they get lost in conversation. I mean, we were talking the other day about, you know, some of the paramedic conferences around the country, and they all just seem to follow the same topics year in, year out from some of the same people delivering them, and we miss some of the really important conversations. So I think this podcast is important because we're going to unpack some of those other topics. And we were speaking earlier about provisional diagnoses because historically paramedics are encouraged to identify provisional diagnoses. But is there a point that they are encouraged to look at too many?
Mm.
I don't know, Lou.
Mm. Yeah.
Lou, your background, I mean, you're still studying at the moment. I mean, Technically all of us are still studying. We've entered a profession. We study for our entire lives.
Yeah.
Where are you at with provisional diagnoses?
It's certainly sort of what's drilled into you at university because it guides your management plan for that patient. So in order to treat a STEMI, you need to know how it presents. You know, what the ECG looks like, and then you can go ahead with your treatment. So at university, it's definitely what underpins a lot of what we're taught.
Really, the provisional diagnosis is a consequence, or the consequence of a provisional diagnosis is the treatment that you're providing the patient. So you can't apply the treatment algorithm without having the gateway or the diagnosis in the first place.
Yep.
So if you want to go and apply something specific like a STEMI, I want to do X, Y, and Z, I need a diagnosis to get me there.
Yeah.
But let's go all the way back and go, well, what are all the things that happened before a provisional diagnosis that leads us to get there? What are we doing? What are we doing, Lou?
What are we doing when we go?
How do we get to a provisional diagnosis?
Our impression of the patient.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You could even call it an interview of the patient because we're going with no information. Yep. We're going with some information depending on where you work because at the end of the day, paramedics are always called to a patient and normally they've passed on some information, but essentially we're interviewing them.
Yeah.
We're gathering information either from the questions we ask, from the examinations that we perform, from the vital signs that we take, and we're applying that to a set of known knowledge about medicine and then forming an impression of the patient. Have you heard of something called hypothetico-deductive reasoning?
Only from you?
Have you heard of that?
Only from you.
Jesus. Is that one word?
I can't spell it.
One more time.
Hypothetico-deductive reasoning.
Yeah, I still can't unpack that, Lou, if you can help me out with that one.
So you could even break it down. It's a really interesting way. You're all doing it. We do it every day.
Trust Nick to come up with one of the longest words since Super Fragicalistic.
Yeah. No, I was asleep one night and I woke up and I was like, that's a cool word. It's this thing that we do anyway. You just don't know you're doing it, right? So hypothetical deductive reasoning is just hypothetical, hypothesis, deductive. You're deducing ideas or concepts or conclusions, and reasoning is just a way of and we're thinking. So essentially what this is how you go about forming an impression of your patient or a diagnosis of your patient. So you'll ask a series of questions or gather a series of bits of information, and you'll start to form conclusions from that information. So for example, you go into a patient and you observe them to be awake and talking to you. So, hey, my name's Nick. And they say, oh, g'day, my name's Jim. And you go, okay, I'm going to hypothesize that this patient is not in cardiac arrest. Fair. And I'm going to form that conclusion.
That's a fair reasoning.
That's
fair reasoning, yeah. I should say.
So I'm then going to gather some more information. I'm going to take some vital signs. I'm going to look at their medications. And I might say, oh, what's wrong? I've got chest pain. Okay. So I'll do a 12-lead ECG and I'll see that there's no major STEMI. So I'll form the conclusion that the patient isn't having a STEMI. So okay, I'm going to have a new hypothesis of what are the all non-STEMI causes of chest pain. So you'll ask some more questions that essentially, what they're aiming to do is either confirm or deny a new thought. So the new thought or hypothesis might be this patient has, I don't know, been stabbed in the chest, and that's why he has chest pain. And then I will look at the chest, see that there's no knife wound, and come to the conclusion that it is probably not caused by a stab wound. And then I'll form a new question, a new hypothesis, go, well, could it be a pleural effusion? So I'll be like, well, have you had surgery or cancer or something like that before? And they go, no. You go, well, it's probably not. So what else could it be? And eventually you whittle your way down until you form a single or multiple impressions of the patient. And that is what ends up being your diagnosis. Now, the problem with this is that a lot of it's very subjective. A lot of it's very much about it relies on your own knowledge and your own biases. And your biases influence it significantly because you can either anchor on certain information and value it to be more important than other information. You might exclude certain bits of information and see that it's not important. Or you might stop gathering information because you're going to anchor on a specific diagnosis and go, that's it, can't be anything else, that's what I'm going with.
There's a number of things that can affect, when you first introduced me to it, my first thought was it would be incredibly vulnerable to bias, which every single patient interview we do is going to be vulnerable to that paramedic's specific bias. But I think it's also important to identify that there's other factors that are going to be at play as well in relation to our bias that can even include things like the time that the call comes into a shift. Mm. Because if I've missed a meal, I'm going to be far more likely to present, a bias differently as opposed to if it was coming into the middle of a shift and I was working anyway, as opposed to if I was trying to finish my shift and I haven't eaten. So it's
end of shift bias. It's a thing.
That's a thing, right?
Yeah. How enthusiastic are you to go and do a really thorough assessment of a patient at 6:27 a.m. in the morning on your second night shift? Are you excited? Are you gonna go hard?
So hypothetic deductive reasoning is going to be influenced by the time.
Yes. And whether or not you've eaten.
Yeah.
And how well you slept.
What are we doing with those provisionals that we came up with?
Why are you looking at me?
I want to hear your perspective on it.
Okay. So what we're doing with the provisional diagnosis?
Well, if we've, using Nick's terminology, deductively reasoned our way into a diagnosis that now we're going to treat, what are we doing with those provisionals that we spent time accumulating? Because like you said, there's a lot of emphasis even in your own education to come up with multiple provisionals because it's safer. Yep. Even out on the street, I've heard this through numerous sources and even through my own experience, which is obviously creating some of my bias around it. There's certainly been a lot of emphasis on you need multiple provisionals to safely manage that patient. And the question is, if we've got to the point where we've made a diagnosis, what are we doing with those provisionals?
Mm. Are we just throwing them out?
I believe I have sometimes.
Is that something that we're handing over to the hospital? you know, look, this is my impression of the patient. This is what I believe they have. However, it could be X, Y, and Z. But at 3 a.m., do you have the capacity to communicate that to the nurse?
Do we need to, though?
Yeah.
Or can we just present an undifferentiated patient?
Yes.
Because I think sometimes if we do some assessments, right? Let's say we do a bunch of assessments on the patient. We go, you have this type of abdo pain, or your headache is normal, or whatever. It's going to affect not only the treatment we do, but you also have to think of disposition as treatment, right? So if I say, I think your headache is fine, I will come to the conclusion that you don't need to seek further assessment for that headache.
Yeah.
Rather than go, well, I can't really say that your headache is fine. There's a reason you've called me for a headache. That's a red flag that someone would call an ambulance or seek assessment for a headache when headaches are a pretty common condition. And really go looking for those subtle little features of that presentation that makes you a little bit worried enough to go, I can't rule this out. Therefore, it needs something higher. I think sometimes we need to leave our ego at the door and realize that as paramedics, we don't have all the tools we need to make diagnoses. The role of a doctor is to be a diagnostician, is to gather lots of information and have years and years and years of study and knowledge about medicine of the body to be able to make diagnoses. And that's why they have specialties in medicine, is because I can just get really, really, really good at hearts. I can get really, really good at lungs. I can get really, really good at ICU or cancer or palliative care, whatever it is, because there's so much information. You can't have, no one doctor could be an expert in all of that. And that's why they have specialties. So we have to leave our egos at the door and say, we have a little bit of information across a broad section of medicine. We have limited tools to do assessments. We have a blood pressure BSL temp ECG that's very limited. There's so much information that we can't gather for our patient. So we need to leave our egos at the door and recognize that there's very few patients we can truly diagnose. So what are the actual patients you can truly diagnose? Put your hand in your heart and say, this is exactly that.
Hypoglycemia?
Great.
Hyperglycemia?
Great.
Can you diagnose a STEMI?
I think so. Can you?
Out of a hospital, can you? Clinical features.
You can diagnose VF.
Anaphylaxis.
Asystole.
Oh, I can definitely diagnose asystole.
But like, we can't diagnose abdo pains. We can't rule out bad abdo pains. We can't diagnose all those chest conditions.
Yep.
Because you don't have the tools.
Yeah.
So I think sometimes it can be, I think sometimes we get overconfident in our ability to rule out stuff. And then patients get left at home, or they don't get informed properly, or they don't get channeled for further assessment, and they're not entering the healthcare system because we haven't been able to, because we've made a provisional diagnosis of this patient's okay.
Can I ask what your opinion is on ruling out a diagnosis? What is your opinion on that?
I don't think we can rule out anything.
Yep. Do you agree, Sonny?
So dumping a provisional diagnosis.
Going, no, that's not what that is.
It's a game of odds. I think it's percentages. There are certainly some provisionals that would have a much, much lower percentage of likelihood than some of the others. The thing is, Lou, the more that I studied in paramed, the more I had to accept that we actually know so little about the human body and how it functions. I used to see paramedics, you know, on the street. This is two lifetimes ago now, and think, gee, that person's a genius. And now I see my colleagues on the street and I'm like, wow, you guys are playing a good game of pretending, because there's so many things that we don't know. There's so many interventions that will cause two different reactions in two different patients who are presenting with the same symptoms. So it's a game of odds for me, and that might seem callous. It might even seem risky, but at the end of the day, the limited knowledge that we do have, the limited access to diagnostic equipment that we have, and the limited and fractured information that we're often given during cases make things incredibly difficult. That said, have I ever ruled out a provisional diagnosis? Yes. In fact, so many that I've lost count. And I guess therein lies the next question, is that safe?
Is it safe to rule things out? Depends what you do when you rule them out. So I could rule out a bunch of different.
Dumped it. It's literally here.
Yeah.
Dumped.
Gone.
Sonny's going down this treatment pathway.
I think if you can, if you dump it, you don't have the flexibility of mind to be able to reconsider it as you gather more information.
What about the distraction?
Oh. What do you mean?
I'm trying to treat something critical.
Mm.
Mm.
I don't want the distraction of that provisional impacting what I'm attempting to do. It's
yeah,
delicate.
You have to be flexible in your.
Oh, I agree.
You have to be agile. You have to be able to go, I'm going to have it. Because at the end of the day, there's another really cool concept, right?
Oh yes. Gosh.
If it's more than five syllables, I don't want to know.
I can draw it for you. It's four words.
Oh, it's more.
Right. Have you heard of the OODA loop?
Was that a word?
OODA. Observe. Orientate. Decide. Act. It's a loop. You go round and round and round.
Right? OODA.
OODA loop.
Oh, it's, right? It's an acronym. The OODA loop. What is step one?
Step one. So OODA stands for observe.
So OODA orientate. Stands for O-D. No. O-O-D-A. Right. Correct. O-O-D-A. Observe.
Orientate. Decide. Act.
Right.
So it's a
OODA.
It's a thinking process.
Google it.
So let's use the example of someone in Cattigrast. You walk into the house and you observe a man who's unconscious. You orientate to yourself that, oh, that could be a cardiac arrest. You decide that you need to apply the pads to assess their rhythm, and then you act by putting the pads on. You observe a squiggly line on the monitor. You orientate yourself to the fact that that is VF. You decide that you need to shock it, so you shock it. You know what I mean? And you go around and around and around in circles. When we dump a provisional diagnosis, you're essentially cutting off one side of the OODA loop. You observe, you orientate yourself to that information, you decide that you don't need to do anything with it, and you exclude it, right?
So I could have this as the OODD. Observe, orientate, decide.
Throw out.
Act, do, and just do. No, I'm joking.
act. But the whole point of it is, after you've made an action, you have to go and then observe the consequence of that action. Orientate yourself to any new information you now have, and then make a new decision about what's next. And you're constantly going round and round and round, so and constantly reassessing, gathering more, reassessing. Because your provisional diagnosis, I see this all the time with junior clinicians. You back them up, you have a chat, they've gathered some information, they're like, it's this. And you gather more information, and it suddenly changes the impression of your patient because we've just added more information into the
situation. So there's two ways that it can change a provisional then to a different provisional. Could be more, but one is the addition of more information, right? So you've just investigated a little bit more thoroughly. And so now you've got more information, and that's going to put you on a different path, a different diagnosis. The other would be how the patient responds to the current act or to the current intervention. So if we're using OODA, the act, the patient will either hopefully improve based on what we're doing, maybe not move at all, and maybe even deteriorate. Now, deterioration is, I don't want to use the term easy because nothing's actually easy out there sometimes, especially at the end of long shifts. But normally when they deteriorate from an intervention, it's a fairly safe bet that maybe we're on a path that we shouldn't be on. Mm. The patients who don't really respond, though, they can be the challenging ones because it could be neither here nor there. But I think this OODA loop is an important tool for clinicians to use because it certainly keeps the dynamices of what we're doing alive. It's no different to, you hear a lot of junior clinicians talking about we need to assess danger before we do anything. And I think I wish that wasn't step one in so many of their algorithms because danger is such a dynamic thing that it should just be a continual assessment.
Omnipresent, right?
Yeah, just across the lifespan of the case. And there's so many different facets to it. It's not just your own personal danger. It's also the clinical danger to, the patient or their physical danger. It goes on and on and on. But I think what's lost is the dynamicity of that one part of what we do. And I think this OODA loop is a really important tool because it speaks volumes to the dynamicities of our ongoing clinical assessments.
Mm. Lou, how often do you, in your training, look at patients who are undifferentiated? Or is it always just clear information, diagnosis?
Yes, it's generally
treatment pathway, patient gets better.
Yes. Yep. I will say 99% of the time it's black and white.
I think, and you used to be an educator, you still are an educator.
But also, it's, say you're doing trauma.
Yeah.
You've done TBIs.
Yeah.
You go in, it's TBI week.
You.
What are you going to be presented with? TBI.
The challenge of the educational paradigm at the moment is the student is either going to be wrong or right. And if they're right, then they keep progressing. If they're wrong, then they're held back and have to repeat. But I think that's also a trap because, like you just alluded and Lou confirmed, is how often are they actually presented patients who aren't just one or the other, you know? The challenge with paramed education at the moment is, one, we've been really slow to adapt highly immersive and high fidelity training. There's always the discussion around cost that comes into play. I don't believe that is a fair or accurate approach to paramedic education. I think if aviation can spin their simulations to the point where it feels like you're flying a plane on the ground, surely we can adapt and improve paramedic education. But how do you assess a student's ability in assessing a patient when for the last, 40, 50 years, we've literally had a pass-fail? You're right, you're wrong. That's a contraindication, you failed, et cetera, et cetera. We're not looking at, and this is my, this is my own bias from my experience, is we're not looking at the student's ability over the lifespan of their degree as much as we should be, because they're are still students who will be getting 98%, high distinctions on their assignments and their presentations, et cetera, but then they can literally do a scenario and have a bad day at the end of a semester and make what is deemed a critical fail. They come back and repeat, and then they can fail it twice. So we can have students who are at 98% who are failing and failing and failing, and I don't think that's an accurate reflection of their actual clinical ability, because if we assessed professional paramedics the same way on the street, then, and you've heard it before, I will lose my registration. It's such a fear factor that just doesn't exist. People don't understand the structure in Australia if that's their biggest fear. But if we actually assessed qualified paramedics the same way we do students, half of the qualified paramedics wouldn't be able to practice. We're failing students in a classroom for mistakes that a professional paramedic can make on the street, but the professional paramedic is afforded the ability to reflect and improve, whereas the student is just cut off. So I think that's a whole other discussion. It's a whole other podcast around paramedic education, but it's an interesting one when we're talking about provisional diagnoses, because, this whole segue even just came about because you asked Lou.
Can I share with my experience for placement?
Oh, go on.
Okay. So I understand that with the education system.
Is this just for me, is this ambulance placement or paramedic placement? Like, which, because there's both, there's non-ambulance.
Ambulance placement.
Great. Thank you.
My first year, it was, get your diagnosis so you can get your management plan and your treatments going. When I went out on road and started, doing sample and getting history from people, I had no idea what was wrong with these people. I was very lost because I'm like, but hang on, they're not presenting the way that I have been taught at university. And it took me a few weeks to realize that this isn't how it's going to be. And it really threw me when I went in there and I started asking my questions. And I'm like, this isn't croup, or this isn't COPD, or whatever it is. I was very lost, and I actually really struggled for the first week or so as a student that was sort of the, primary care officer getting the history and all that stuff. I was not prepared for the amount of patients we went to that were very vague. And sometimes we didn't figure out what was even wrong with them.
So were you comfortable saying that's a respiratory depressed patient?
Like, could you give them a broader impression rather than going,
that's abdo pain.
Correct.
Whereas in my head, I'm trying to figure out, well, is it ACS?
Lou, I'll share a story with you from my student years, which again goes back to 2 decades. I mean, the irony that I'm an educator and academic is not lost on me, because spelling is something I've struggled with my whole life, as is attention spans and everything else. But look, when I came into my final assessment, my capstone assessment, I mean, anyone out there who's been through any element of paramedic education understands the nerves involved. We had our final practical assessment. It's my last hurdle. And I walked in, and the patient was made up as best she could be to look pale, sweaty, and in excruciating amounts of pain. And my brain went to mush, because there was just so much going on. There were so many people watching me. There was so much riding on this decision. And when I was asked to make a diagnosis, I blurted out belly pain and then just wanted to die. Belly pain. It's not the easiest thing in the world to spell, right? And I continued the case. I managed her pain as best I could. I managed her symptomatically. And then I left with my tail between my legs thinking, well, here goes another year, right? And I nearly fell off my chair when I found out I had passed because a lot of smarter people than me had actually failed. And the ones who had failed had diagnosed appendicitis, had diagnosed ectopic pregnancy, had diagnosed several other very specific things. And this is probably the only assessment I've ever had in my life that was actually a vague assessment because they didn't want a specific assessment. They wanted the patient to be managed symptomatically. They wanted the patient's pain to be managed. And so although I was counseled around terminology, probably belly pain isn't the most professional medical or useful thing to describe, I wasn't wrong. So it is an interesting dynamic when we approach paramedic education. But I mean, that was a scenario that was set up 20 years ago. Why has there not been more of it? It was just about the only one I can remember.
I think what we do now has value. Like going in and having very clear, this is a guy with chest pain. It's down his both arms. He has an abnormal ECG and he's got, you know, high blood pressure, blah, blah, blah. And he has ACS. We give some GTN. His pain gets better. He has some aspirin. And we high five and put an IV in. That has value because when you're new in paramedicine, you need to be able to learn how to do good pattern recognition, right? You need to be able to take the information you have, apply it to patterns that you see in a patient, and then come to a conclusion and then do something about it. That's an important cognitive skill that you have to develop. And that's great, but you have to take it one step further and start to include those undifferentiated patients because there's so much, there's such a big cohort in what we do. And there's so many times that I've come across patients and I have said, you're fine, or it's not a major issue, or it's not significant, and they've got a, you know, dissecting aorta from their neck to their belly, or they've got sepsis, or they've got something else. And, you know, you're always, doesn't matter how long you're in the job, you're going to be wrong. So you're better off having an impression of your patient. I think the language is better because I think it's broader and it keeps you open-minded. Because the other thing is, what do you think is going to happen when you turn up to a hospital with your patient and you say, he's just got a headache, or he doesn't have appendicitis, he couldn't have appendicitis.
Not just from the hospital though, but I mean, paramedics are very competitive and paramedics are very opinionated. What? Ask me my opinion, I'll give it, right? Well, what that means—
Isn't that this podcast?
But it means so often than not, I've heard a crew come in with a diagnosis, and then there'll be talk, sometimes with them and sometimes not with them, sometimes behind their back around the provisionals that another paramedic thinks it is. So if you come in and say it's just a headache, I'd suspect there's going to be a crew who disagree, and I've got another provisional.
So what do you think the role of a paramedic is then? If it's not to be a diagnostician, what is the role of a paramedic?
But why are we not? What, I thought we were.
We don't have the tools.
So what are we?
What else?
Yeah.
That was the question.
That's a great question.
It's a great question. Thanks for asking. I'd like to thank my sponsors. I have to blame the Labor Party for that.
Luke, for the record, I'm really glad Nick asked you this question.
Oh, I know.
It's a difficult one.
Aren't you the academic?
Well,
it took me 10 years to figure this out.
Okay.
As a paramedic, to figure out what the role of a paramedic is. What one of the roles of a paramedic is.
There's many roles, isn't there?
There's many.
Many, many roles. Well, you're advocating for that patient. Yeah. So when you go to hand over to the triage nurse, you're advocating for the direction of where that patient needs to go. So say it's a stroke.
Hmm.
Whatever it may be.
So your patient
advocation.
I think she just summarized the role of a paramedic in two words.
Patient advocate. I love that.
Yes. And you're safeguarding.
Yes.
For that patient.
No, just keep it at two words.
Oh, sorry. Patient, too many words for Sunny.
Patient advocate.
Yeah.
Is there a space between safe and guard?
No, there's too many words. Here, cross it out. Word. Patient advocate.
Patient advocate.
You really are. Right.
So it only dawned on me recently, right, that a paramedic, our role is not to be a diagnostician. It's for us to assess the patient and figure out what is the best disposition. What part of the healthcare system does this patient need to access and how can I help them access it? So do they need a hospital? Maybe, maybe not. Not every patient we go to needs to go to a hospital. Crazy.
What?
not every patient needs a hospital. Some do, some don't, right? Some need an urgent care centre. Some need follow-up with their GP. Some need referral to a social services. Some need referral to a diabetic service. And in 2024, there's more and more options open to us beyond just the hospital. So we're there to help the patient navigate the healthcare system. And sometimes paramedics are the first people that the patient has contact from the healthcare system. And we are their step into the healthcare, their healthcare pathway. And we need to be their advocate. So sometimes just saying, hey, you don't need to go to hospital, bye, isn't being a patient advocate. Yep. It's, you have a problem, how do we fix it?
Yep. So you're a patient navigator or your healthcare navigator.
You are a healthcare navigator.
Add that to the list.
Because they go 000 or they go, you know, ring up you up on the radio or however or whatever capacity you're working as a paramedic. They might be on a mine site or a work site and say, hey, can I see the paramedic? You are the access into healthcare because you are the low-hanging fruit for them.
Yep.
It's easy.
Yep.
You come to me.
It's very similar to my line of work as an emergency vet nurse in that on the weekends, no regular vets are open. Where do they go? They go to us. It might be as simple as sort of an ear infection, but they don't know where else to go. So we are there to direct them to the best pathway for that patient. So it's sort of similar to paramedicine in that although it's not an emergency, there's nowhere else for these owners to go other than the emergency department on the Sunday.
I'm still anchored on patient navigator.
Patient.
Get that on the back of your shirt.
Patient navigator.
What is the name of the navigator in Top Gun? Was it Goose or Maverick?
That was Goose.
You're going to call you Goose from now on.
Nick, you said disposition before. Yes. The disposition of that patient.
Yes.
The only way we can get to that point is through the diagnosis or provisional diagnosis identification.
Impression,
which does come with risk.
Mm.
So the question originally asked was, are provisional diagnoses useful or harmful? How do you navigate professional? How do you navigate provisional diagnoses?
How do you navigate them?
To manage the risk of being wrong.
There's always a risk of being wrong, and we need to accept that.
Do you think paramedics are willing to accept that out in the street?
Well, they do accept it because...
No, they don't. The fear of being wrong causes a lot of paramedics to actually practice unreflectively, hide mistakes.
And also be incredibly conservative and not take on any level of risk. And that's where this take everything the hospital comes from. Because I'm not sure, I don't want to be wrong.
Yeah.
Because if I'm wrong, I'll get in trouble. If I get in trouble, I'll lose my registration and I need my income. Therefore, the low-hanging fruit is just everyone goes to hospital. Whereas other health services, in the UK, if your transport rates are greater than like, I don't know, 50%, they're like, what are you doing? You can take your patients elsewhere. They actively encourage people to take patients either outside of a hospital to alternative means or not transport them. And they're willing to accept a level of collateral damage because of that. Because the health system can't handle taking everything to hospital because it just gets overwhelmed.
So are their paramedics supported then?
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
But our paramedics are too, because at the end of the day, it's not about being wrong. It's about making a reasonable decision with the information that you have at time. If you come to a conclusion and based on that, you've done good, thorough assessments and you've made a reasonable decision with that information and your peers would also agree that that is reasonable based on the information you had at the time, then that's fine. I guess people get upset or they get scared because they're like, well, I'm going to be judged based on the diagnosis that happens after the fact.
That fear, though, because Lou just raised a really good question, are the paramedics over in the UK supported to make those decisions? All right. Or you said, are the paramedics here supported? And I think the fear that you're talking about there, Nick, actually comes from a lack of support. It actually comes from a culture of judgment and harshness.
Correct. Because what happens is the reflection, and this isn't, we're not speaking for every organization or every employer. Some are really, really, really good at this and some have a lot of work to do. And that's it. And individuals are really, really good at this and individuals have a lot of work to do. I think what happens is we make impressions or we make assessments of your ability based on the diagnosis that happened after the fact with information that you weren't privy to at the time. So, for example, if I say to you, why did you treat this patient for hyperkalemia? Their potassium was 3 on the gas. You're an idiot. Well, that's very unfair because you don't have the the convenience of a blood gas. So how are you going to make the decision? But you made the decision based on the clinical features of the patient and, you know, what you thought was reasonable at the time, then that's how it should be looked at, not based on the information that you didn't have at the time. But the latter is what happens sometimes.
The flip side to that assessment of someone's ability is not just translated to, you know, their access to equipment or whatever else they have. The person who's making that assessment of someone's ability is also impacted by their own bias. So they're actually more likely to be much harsher in their assessment of someone's ability if they don't like someone. And again, their bias comes in. They might not like them because of their gender, their race, their appearance, the way they speak. And I think, again, this lack of awareness around people's bias is actually like it comes full circle and is actually one of the biggest issues when we talk about the safety and rigor of professional diagnosis. Because, you know, when we talked about coming into, let's say, an emergency room or a handover or somewhere, and you say something like, you know, my patient's got a headache, there'll be paramedics who agree with you because they like you, and there'll be paramedics who disagree with you because they don't like you. It's actually not got nothing to do with an assessment of your ability. And it takes us down a whole new rabbit warren, you know, and it's a whole nother discussion. It could be another podcast on professional behavior, but it impacts our ability to actually make a rigorous assessment of a clinician's ability to make an assessment of that patient. Oh, I need a drink.
Now, what's the better way to approach it then, Lou? So if we, rather than going, oh, you were wrong with that new information that we have, how do we approach it better?
By the oodle technique, right?
The oodle.
The spaghetti technique.
It's making me hungry.
The ooda.
No, that's a really good question.
That's actually a really good approach though, Lou. I mean, the reason I enjoy these talks so much is because I actually take so much away from them for my own practice, my own clinical ability.
You can use that.
This and is great.
OODA.
OODA? Not oodles?
Oodle. Okay. Not oodle, oodle.
Who's dyslexic now?
Observe, orientate, decide, act.
Yeah.
OODA.
But we can use this. So what happens is, you know, instead of going, oh, you know, that patient's hyperkalemic, you're not very smart. Right? We go, oh, that patient was hyperkalemic. How did they present?
Yeah.
You know, that patient wasn't hyperkalemic. Sorry, my apologies. How do they present? Can you see how the diagnosis of hyperkalemia is really difficult without a blood gas? So rather than turning into a you're right or you're wrong and get painted with this big dirty stick, you need to look at it as an opportunity for learning and reflection.
Yes,
so bringing that information after the fact in is really important, but we have to allow it to happen and we need to allow it to bring it in and to be wrong. Well, wrong. I don't think we're wrong though. I think wrong's the wrong word. I think it's you have an impression of the patient. If it wasn't what you thought, that's okay. That's what happens. That's medicine, right?
It is. Yeah. I think you're right. It shouldn't be labeled as wrong because given the level of information that you had at that time, it was the most appropriate.
Yep.
Oh, I was going to say assumption. It would be the most appropriate action.
Impression.
But as more information comes to light, we should have the flexibility and support to change.
So, Lou, what advice would you give to people? We'll wrap it up.
Yeah.
What advice would you give to people?
I think the OODA technique is great, but I think adding something onto the end of that, and that is self-reflecting. So whether that's going and following up on the case and growing your knowledge around that case and how you manage that case to go, okay, well, it was in my impression, it was hyperkalemia. However, the blood gas said that it wasn't. So you just need to sort of divert and self-reflect as well.
OODAR. OODA. Reflection.
Reflection. Yeah.
I mean, we should be able to reflect whilst we're on scene. This is not just something we should unpack later. We've got 20 minutes to write something down. We still should be reflecting and then observing.
Yes, absolutely.
What's your advice, Sonny?
Do you know, years ago, I seriously hurt a patient. All right. Now, it was a night shift. It was 3 a.m. And when we were dispatched to a short of breath. 93-year-old. 3 a.m. And when we got there, the patient's aging daughter was quite panicked at the door and said, quick, quick, mum's in here. She's having an asthma attack. And we walked in and you could hear her wheezing, expiratory and inspiratory wheezing, audibly without a stethoscope. And she looked pale. She looked rough. She looked like she was hurting. And so, you know what we did? We started treating her for asthma. Right then and there, let's fix her. This poor old girl needs help. And over the course of the next 5 minutes, after giving her sympathomimetics and all kinds of things. She was worse. And I remember turning to my offsider, just saying, hey, what are the vitals? Well, she's tachycardic and she's hypertensive. Shit. It's 3 a.m, she's hypertensive. How hypertensive is she? 210 systolic. So I turned the patient's sword and said, hey, when was the last time your mother had an asthma attack? And she said, oh, when she was 20. She's 93. So given the new information, I certainly redirected quickly to a cardiogenic cause. And I had to be the one in the hospital. Well, I actually had to be the one to call for backup first because this poor old girl was falling off a cliff. And I had to be the one in hospital to say, hey, here's a cardiogenic APO that we just fed a bunch of salbutamol and Atrovent, everything else to. And it's just silence. You're like, yeah. But we had to go back and reflect on that case and try and unpack what we did. Now, would a provisional diagnosis have helped in this situation? Look, probably. But given the information we had presented to us, did we have the right to act? Well, yes and no. And this is where people can have their own bias and their own opinions. There's going to be people who don't like me who are harsher, people who do like me who'd pat me on the back and say it's okay. But I think when we're unpacking this information too, we need to be cautious to act. Sometimes it's better to sit on your hands and actually try and elicit that little bit more information, because a 93-year-old suffering cardiogenic APO fed Atrovent and salbutamol at high rates is never going to be a beneficial thing, as opposed to getting there and doing nothing at all. So the takeaway for me is, whilst we are moving through our interviews, sometimes it's better just to take a step back. Yes, they might be critical. Yes, they might be sick, but just take a minute, and it could be the wrong decision.
And that's okay. It's all learning. So many of our patients are undifferentiated. So many times we're going to get our provisional diagnosis and not going to be what ends up being wrong with the patient. That's okay. That's medicine. That's why it's fun. That's why it's half an art and half a science. But I think that's a good chat. Strong chat.
Strong chat.
Time for coffee. Hey, let's wrap it up. Thanks very much, guys.
Thank you.
If you've got any questions, qualms, queries, or concerns, please reach out to us. You can find us on Instagram. We're on Facebook. You can find us on our website, www.theshiftextension.org. .org.
Yeah.
Or send us an email. Until next time, see you later.